Okay, we are in Galatians 4, where we left off last week. Galatians 4. Just a little bit of a review over where we were last week. Paul's argument, as he continued in addressing the Galatians, the question he asked early on is, the sense that they've left really left Christ. Amazed that you are so quickly deserting him and called you for a different gospel. So we see early on that it's about the gospel in chapter 1. And then chapter 3 says, O foolish Galatians who have bewitched you. And it's in the context about, the essentials of the gospels or the gospel. And as he continues, and last week the argument moved into the sense of, as it has been, it's all, virtually about the law, as the Judaizers have come in and evidently convinced most people, and this would be Jews and Gentiles, that there has to be an adherence to the law in their Christian walk. And so these, essentially, as you're looking at the primary readers of this letter, they didn't come, they haven't become Christians or they haven't become part of the church by adhering to the law, but it's after, it's a post-Christian experience that they've now moved back in the sense of the law, or in the case of Gentiles, who've started embracing certain things of the law. And so he made this comparison about the law and a guardian that would be put over some free person that has a potential inheritance in the future, but yet as a child growing up there really isn't a difference between them and somebody that has no inheritance, but the inheritance comes. And saying the law was in that regard. And keeps moving. Verse 7 says, therefore you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir through God. So he's looking at that sense of the promise, the idea of inheritance. He ends in verse 11. He says, I fear for you that perhaps I have labored over you in vain. That there's an emptiness here. Now, this would be one of those passages, if you took it in isolation, that you could look at this and say, well, Paul's saying that they've lost their salvation, that it's all empty, it's all, pointless, his efforts toward them, that they were never believers or that they've lost their salvation. But that doesn't fit Paul if you see it in the whole, But in this particular passage, if you just isolated it, you could make that implication. And so when we know that that's not his view theologically throughout his writings, then we're looking at this, that the sense of laboring in vain is that they're not moving in their Christian life. It's not that, his initial ministry to them wasn't fruitful because they did become believers. But as believers, his labor with them, if they just continue in this, becomes empty. It becomes for naught because they've returned to a post-Christian concept instead of moving forward with Jesus Christ. Well, he, having made that statement, then he moves on. He says in verse 12 of chapter 4, he says, I beg you, brethren. And so you see the relationship of saying, I fear this. Well, when he's saying, I fear, for you, there's a it seems to me that that's a way of putting things in terms of identification, of care, of concern. I fear for you. If you really don't care about anybody at that point, you're going, oh, this is what's going to happen to you, or this is what's happened, or it was all worthless. I regret that I ever wasted my time with you, but, I fear for you. And then he moves in verse 12 and it says, I beg of you, brethren, become as I am. For I also have become as you. Obviously, you know, in those passages, you're always asking Paul things like that. What do you mean? You know, become as I, because I've become as you. And well, in one sense, he hasn't become as them. I mean, he's not embracing Judaism, so it's not that he's talking about. He continues, "You have done me no wrong." So when he's looking back and saying, in verse 4, "I fear that perhaps I have labored over you in vain," it's not that they've offended Paul, or in the sense of they've wronged Paul, but they're losing out. And when Paul looks back in relationship, he's saying, you know, we have a good relationship. You haven't done me wrong. You haven't, you know, there was times when you reached out to me. He says, "You have done me no wrong, but you know that it was because of a bodily illness that I preached the gospel to you the first time. And that which was a trial to you in my bodily condition, you did not despise or loathe, but you received me as an angel of God, as Christ Jesus himself." That here we don't have any great theological, or I mean great historical setting, you know, background to fill us in on what's going on here. We just have this little text and reading somewhat between the lines that Paul was physically ill, and that something with that illness, Paul is saying, you know, you could have taken the opportunity just to reject me, but you didn't. You embraced me and received the message I had. And he's looking at that in terms of saying, you know, I care about you. You were kind to me. You were, you know, there's a certain sense of, you know, I owe you almost. That he's saying now from this, and he'll continue and talk out, say some more, but this idea of illness, you know, it people often feel compelled to come up with answers, you know, and I'm not sure why, other than, you know, we're generally, we like everything complete. We don't like loose ends. And I, you know, if you watch movies that have one of those endings that's wrapped up. I'm sorry, what?
Yeah.
Sometimes you go, okay, they're making a sequel to it. You know, the guy's dead, and then all of a sudden, you know, he kind of opens his eyes. You know, oh, okay. You know, but he's not, you know, everything's led to being dead. But I mean, sometimes when they're just kind of vague, yeah, I don't, you know, I don't think I saw that. Did I see that? Don't. But those leave me just like, yeah, kind of like, oh, why not watch this, you know? And so, you know, maybe that's why, you know, we're prone to do that. But you know, it makes this reference so people start coming up with these things that, you know, got to have it. And there's a few places where Paul talks about, you know, these things. You know, in the, you know, in Corinthians where he makes reference that he was caught up in the, you know, heaven and, you know, this thorn has been given to him. You know, he's prayed three times, and but, you know, this becomes, you know, God's grace is sufficient, and it seems to be a kind of a reminder, you know, because he had such a, you know, incredible experiences, you know, beyond, you know, human experience, so to speak, and so now he has this thorn. Well, what's that thorn? And some people tie it to this, and we'll see in a moment. He talks about you would have plucked out your eyes, and so that becomes this idea. Well, he had eye problems, but that doesn't allow for the figure of speech of saying I'd plucked out my eyes for you, being a figure of speech saying, you know, maybe more today we wouldn't say that, but we might say, you know, I'd give my right hand to you. I don't know if we say I'd give you my right eye so much today, but we say I'd give you my, you know, my right hand or whatever. You know, I think that's that. But then, so from that, you'll often you'll hear people say, "Well, Paul had these eye problems." That's what, you know, with thorn. And I remember there are very few things I remember from church as a kid. You know, being in church service. You know, growing up in a very liberal church that never talked about anything. You know, one of the things, which maybe is a blessing. You know, one of the things about liberal churches probably still today. I know for it's probably still going on today. But you know, since you know the definitely the 70s and 80s, definitely the 80s with process theology is that you know they talk about God all the time and talk about the Bible. They just redefine everything. You know, it's just not the God that you know. And so maybe it's better when they don't talk about God because at least I didn't have all these Bible stories told to me backwards, but they just ignored the Bible. But I remember this him talking, one of the pastors. You know, I grew up in a church where you know you had a different pastor every year, but because they moved them around. But the thorn in the flesh was, and I think he'd written some paper in seminary on it, but it was, you know, Paul's wife. And you kind of got to wonder, well, you know, why do you feel compelled to answer that question, number one? And then, you know, where do you come up with that? And, you know, well, that may be an indication of his, you know, of his marriage. Not Paul's marriage, but this pastor's marriage, you know. Yeah. Yeah, he has the right, but there's not much indication that he had one. But that's what I'm saying. You know, you get these people feel compelled to do these things, and I don't. But it and we see it in this passage. We'd like to know. I mean, it just makes you. It feels a lot more complete if I could say, you know, here, you know, Paul had, he was having some, some problem and. You know, his balance was, you know, off, and he, you know, couldn't stand up, and he was falling down. People having to help him up, or he had a broken leg, and he's limping around, or, you know, he had polio. You know, I mean, if you had something, it just makes you feel better. But we don't know. That's the point. It's not necessary to know that he had some condition, and they didn't despise him or loathe him. Now, you know, that can come from a couple of reasons. Sometimes just the fact that people being sick, you stay away from them. And you're talking about, a guest speaker coming in and things. And also this whole idea of the power of the gospel. What do we demand of people, you know, if you're in this? Well, if you're talking about power and the gospel, you know, kind of like when Christ was on the cross, you know, heal yourself. You know, that's what they say. If you're so powerful, if you're, you know, there's a mockery that can come. And this didn't occur. And Paul continues in verse 15, says, where then is that sense of blessing you had? You know, you did these things at that time. This is who you were then. And now look at you. Here you are attacking. And we see this, we saw that very much in 2 Corinthians too. This part would be similar to 2 Corinthians where Paul can refer back to the relationships they had, and now they're attacking them. Where is that? You know, what happened? For I bear you witness that if possible, you would have plucked out your eyes and given them to me. So have I become your enemy by telling you the truth? So this is where we were. Let me remind you of what it was like and what your relationship with me was like. And now I'm your enemy? How's this happened? There was a, and I don't listen to her very often, because I'm not in the car whenever she comes on, I guess, because that's the only time I listen to the radio. But Dr. Laura, and the thing about, I guess, me listening to her is I either really appreciate her insight in some of the questions she asks, or I'm just totally disagreeing with her answer. I'm never kind of neutral, it seems like. But this lady called in and was saying that, you know, her husband died, you know, some years back, and following that, you know, her life just fell apart. And she got into drugs and was doing various things, and her this really good friend and her sister-in-law came to her in this confrontational way of, what now I can't even think of what they call it. What do they call it when you? Thank you. this kind of an intervention. And so, you know, and she, you know, got off drugs and, you know, she's doing better. And she still has a relationship with that friend, but her sister-in-law doesn't have anything to do with her. And so, you know, which turns out they didn't really ever have anything to do and with them, you know, really before that. And so her question is, you know, what can I do? You know, what is my sister-in-law, you know? And you could, and as she started asking her question, you see this bitterness toward the sister-in-law. And Dr. Laura, it was interesting, her statement said, well, you know, regardless if she never calls you again, regardless if you never see her again, every time you think of her, you ought to have good thoughts because she was there when you needed her. And this lady just couldn't, would not buy into that. It was like, but yes, but you know, she's this and she didn't like me before. And Dr. Murray said, it doesn't matter. When you needed her, she was there. So every time you think of her, you ought to have good thoughts because she was there when you needed her. And finally, you know, they hung up, and Dr. Laura said, I don't know, she said something about, you know, people, you know, off drugs, you know, their maturity isn't always, doesn't always catch up with their, you know, their sobriety or whatever, you know. But I, you know, this passage reminds me of that in the sense of that Paul is saying, what happened? You know, why don't you have those good thoughts? And you know, we see this a lot in, I don't know if you see it so much in personal relationships, but you see it in other things, especially. And kind of the phrase in a lot of sports, you know, is as far as fans or, you know, with coaches or schools, it's, you know, what have you done for me lately? It, you know, there's not that sense of, yes, but it's like, hey, but you lost last night. You know, that's all we care about. That's kind of what Paul is saying here. You know, what happened to that sense of blessing? Where, you know, this is the relationship you had, and now I'm your enemy? And I'm your enemy because I'm telling you the truth? And obviously, you know, Paul is very, very skillful in the way that he moves arguments. And so it's that sense of, you know, why would you say I'm your enemy? And then by telling you the truth. Well, they obviously wouldn't say, well, you're my enemy because you told us the truth. They're saying it's something else, but Paul's bringing it back in. But all I've done is tell you the truth. You know, sometimes people, they don't want it. They don't want things to be any way except the way they want it. And so the idea that it's truth is not going to enter into their mind because they've made up their mind, this is the way it has to be. Like I know I have made reference before to this, a guy in South Dakota that, you know, something about, you know, a phrase of, you know, this idea of asking Jesus in your heart whether or not that's the best phrase to use or even a correct phrase in, you know, a helpful phrase in the sense of trusting Christ for salvation. You know, it became, but that's the what my grandmother said. Well, so it's no longer a statement of is it true, is it biblical. It's just simply, this is what I'm used to, and that's the way it's going to be. And see, when you do that, when you move outside the realm of truth, outside the realm of can we talk about what's truth, what's biblical, you know, you're not going to win those arguments, ever. Because it's not a logical argument. It's not an argument based on Scripture. It's not a large argument based upon thinking. It's an argument that's already decided, and that's somewhat where these people are at this point. And when Paul is trying to get them to deal with that, you know, how have I become your enemy by telling you the truth when we had this good relationship? And he moves from there, and he says in verse 17, they eagerly seek you, not commendably, but they wish to shut you out so that you will seek them. And that's a pretty, you know, strong change here as he moves here. You know, they eagerly seek you, and you know, we question, well, who's they? And we don't have a real clear antecedent to there, but it would be those that have come, the Judaizers. You know, they seek you out. they threaten you, you know, you come along and you make people outcast. You can't join us. Therefore, you know, you want in. You know, the writers of the Seinfeld series with the character George is one of the more intriguing characters. He is nothing, you know, ever works out for George. And most of the time it's his own undoing. But one of the things with George is there's this one that they have is, and you know, you see that theme all the way through with him, but there's this one that he's at this point where he has this girlfriend that really likes him, and she's just always wanting to be around and be with George, which is kind of the unusual thing in that series. But Jerry's girlfriend doesn't like George, and it drives George crazy. And so he ignores his girlfriend that really likes him because he can't stand the fact that this girl, this other girl that's not his girlfriend, not going to be his girlfriend, doesn't like him. And, you know, he's consumed with her liking him because she detests him. And, you know, that's almost this. It's you can't be in our club, and so all these people, we want to be in. And, you know, they're mean to him. They condemn him, and they shut him out, and so they seek after him. And it's this exclusive club almost, and so now everybody wants to be in the club. And they've left the truth because people won't let them in. You know, it's so interesting, you know, when you find these things that they're secretive and you can't get in, that people want to be in it. You know, the Masons is a very, you know, intriguing, at least, is, you know, a word for that group. I mean, they're, I mean, in the sense of good to society, there are good things they do. They provide a lot of services. And on the very lower level, it appears that there's not a lot of secrets about getting in, and people are in. But as you go up those levels, that's where it becomes a question of whether or not it's really a religion. I don't know if that show is still around. But, you know, when I have cable, I haven't seen it. Agent John Ankerberg. I don't know if he still has that show, but I was an apologist, and I remember several years ago he was doing this deal on Masons, and had a guy that was a former Mason of some, you know, high order, and they'd be doing these, you know, debates, and you couldn't ever get anywhere because the guy that's a Mason wouldn't acknowledge anything because it's all secretive, so he wouldn't acknowledge anything. And the guy that the former Mason saying all this, well, the only way he can know this is he's portraying something to know it. And, you know, so it retains it. But there's something about this secretive, you know, people want to be a part of. And that's what Paul is addressing here. But he moves on to verse 18. He says, but is it good always to be eagerly sought in a commendable manner, and not only when I am present with you? You know, so they're being sought after, but is that really positive when people want you to be a part of something that's taking you off base? My children, with whom I am again in labor until Christ is formed in you. And now, if you go back to verse 11, where he says, I fear that perhaps I have labored over you in vain. Well, you see in verse 19, it's not that Paul's given up on them. Here in verse 19, he says, I am again in labor until Christ is formed in. That's his goal. Christ formed in you. That's not a statement of salvation, but of maturity in Christ. This would be one of these phrases of being Christ-like, if you would, or moving toward Christ. You know, I'm in labor with you. I'm working with great effort that you would mature in Christ. But I could not wish to be present with you now and to change my tone, for I am perplexed about you. But I could wish to be present with you now and to change my tone, for I am perplexed about you. You know, he longs for this, but yet their whole situation is perplexing. He cares about them, but it's totally confusing because, you know, why have you left what brought you blessing, and you know, now you're rejecting it. If the way, you know, for the Judy, you know, for somebody that says I'm, you know, the way to God is through works, and so that's how I'm approaching God. And then so I'm a Christian because I've worked hard to get in this position, and now to move forward in my Christian life, I keep working hard. There's a consistency there. I don't think he's going to accomplish anything, but it's consistent. But when you look back and you say, the way I became a Christian was through grace, and now I'm going to work hard to improve my position as a Christian, you know, you're going, what? Isn't that a contradiction? I'm perplexed. I'm perplexed why you would embrace me years ago and treat me so great, you know, when I brought the gospel, but now hate me because of the same truth. And so Paul says, I'm perplexed by this. You know, that's really would summarize a lot of things in the Christian life. You know, people that change positions, you know, I'm perplexed. Erica was talking to her mom Sunday, and they had been at church, you know, for Easter, and they were perplexed after the service, talking about it, because while it wasn't ever stated, everything indicated it, that you could lose your salvation, and everything, the whole message was this warning about, you know, living for Christ, and everything suggesting that you could lose your salvation. And that whole sense of security, you could say it's perplexing. Why would God love me so much that he'd give his son for me? Why would God do all these things for me, and yet, you know, and yet I can, you know, fall out of his hands? Or, you know, as some would hold that position, say, well, you know, God would never drop you, but you can jump, you know, out of his hands. You know, that, well, you know, those kinds of things, they become perplexing, because there's a sense of contradictory. Now, there's other things that we might use the word perplexing, but that's probably not the right word. You know, the mystery, how can God choose me, but from my perspective, I choose God? Well, you know, I mean, trying to figure it out may be perplexing, but when we look at it, you got these two truths, and it's hard for us to put them together. You know, there's a mystery. But this is not what Paul's talking about. It's not that kind of a mystery here. It's that sense of, when I look back, you know, you cared about me, but now you see me as my enemy. I told you the truth then. I'm telling you the truth now. And that's kind of where Paul's position is. But if he could be with them, you know, he would like to clobber him, it sounds like. But only because he cares about him. Only because he cares about him. And you've probably been in that situation at some time where you would like to clobber somebody, but it's because they irritate you. You really don't care about them. But there's somebody else you'd like to clobber, and it's because you care so much. And that's where Paul's at, you know, because I care so much. What do you have, insights or questions? Or? Yeah. And that's that. When you care about somebody and it's not, you know, you see them going down the wrong path, it's like, I don't know what to do. And it just, you know, kind of tears you up inside. And that's kind of where he's at now. Yeah.